Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lemis Abdelati from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Theodore McLaughlin about his book, Desertion, Trust and Mistrust in Civil Wars. This book was published by Cornell University Press in 2020. It looks at why soldiers choose to abandon the fight or to switch their allegiances, and how some armed groups manage to hold together. Theo, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So I wonder if you could begin the interview by just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm an associate professor of political science at the Université de Montréal, where I am also the director of the Centre d'études sur la paix et la sécurité internationale, the Center for Peace and for International Peace and Security Studies. My research focuses on civil conflict and military behavior and military politics, of which this book is an example.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show. Let me ask you how you came to write this book.
Well, this book grew out of my dissertation, which itself grew out of a seminar paper in graduate school, which was actually about the Middle East on desertion during uprisings in the 1970s. This was a paper I wrote a few years before the uprisings of 2011, actually. And it grew out of my fascination with civil wars and really wanting to understand desertion and defection at the micro level. And I wanted to focus on civil wars in particular. There's a rich literature on military cohesion, and that literature focuses mostly on international conflict. Sort of doesn't really differentiate between international and civil wars, but these questions in the Civil War context are especially fascinating for me. In a civil war, the question of loyalty can be a really open question. Which side are you on in a society that's divided among multiple armed factions? Civil wars geographically provide a lot of opportunities to leave very often in a country that that a soldier potentially knows well and has networks in. And there's a real complexity of motivations, potentially inciting an individual to join up and potentially to leave. And so I came at this question with the hope of trying to explore desertion and loyalty in civil wars in a lot greater detail. The other thing that pushed me to write this book is that studying civil wars in the mid-2000s when I was in graduate school, it came in the mid and late 2000s. We had a lot of studies of rebel recruitment. That was something that was really, really popular at the time and where there was a lot of scholarship, but there was less known about soldiers choosing to leave an army. The decision to me isn't necessarily a mirror image. Things change once an individual joins an armed group. And ultimately, this is also a phenomenon that matters quite a lot. If you think of, for example, the mass defection in the Syrian army in 2011 and 2012 that really fed the rebellion, the same phenomenon occurring in Libya, in the Libyan civil war starting in 2011. Or if you think of the Iraqi army's collapse at Mosul, the long-running desertion problems in the Afghan National Army, desertion and defection, I think, are really critical for victory and defeat in civil conflict. And as I get to in the book, the decisions that soldiers make around desertion and the decisions that armed groups make around controlling desertion can really wind up shaping what people's experience of civil war is like. So that's broadly how I came to the subject. How I came to the case. I mean, the book is mostly focused on the Spanish Civil War. And my interest in that was really sparked because of a chance remark of a friend of mine who wasn't even a political scientist, who mentioned how fascinating he found the Spanish Civil War and suggested I take a look. And the more I looked, the more I realized, you know, he was right, that it was an extremely rich case that offered me a lot of leverage over the questions I wanted to ask. So that's the genesis.
That's fascinating, and the result is a very sophisticated book with so much policy relevance, and we'll talk much more about the Spanish Civil War, but to sort of clarify, your understanding of desertion in the book covers both what we might think of as desertion proper, where soldiers leave the fighting entirely, and also defection, where they might switch sides, right, and go to a different armed group, and the book develops what you call a relational approach to desertion. Now, the argument is very, very nuanced, right, in the book, but I wondered if you could give us maybe the broad contours of the theoretical argument here.
You bet. And so the relational approach to desertion focuses really on trust and mistrust among combatants and between combatants and their armed groups as drivers of desertion. So broadly speaking, trust among combatants keeps soldiers fighting. Mistrust gets them to desert. And what drives trust and mistrust in turn are perceptions about how committed others are, both in the sense of committed to the cause of the armed group and the sense of committed to fighting for, to really be willing to take on the burdens of fighting in a war. So this cashes out in two major issues. So the first is how trust is formed among groups of combatants. And what I look at in the book are factors above all, like costly signals that soldiers send to each other. So in some units, in some armed groups, soldiers have to prove their commitments to each other through, for example, longstanding ties that they have from pre-war networks like activist groups. Another source of really important source of costly signals of proving your willingness to fight is joining up when you don't have to, and when joining up implies that you're taking on a real burden. You know, the armed group is asking you to do a lot and to commit to a lot, to rigorous discipline, to rigorous training, to being willing to obey orders even when those are risky. If you're willing to join up in those circumstances, that sends a fairly costly signal. And as well, the battlefield itself and what soldiers actually do when in battle sends a signal to their fellow soldiers. And so in armed groups where soldiers continually send these signals to each other, their commitment to fight, in these armed groups, in my view, desertion winds up being a lot less likely. And even soldiers who are initially fairly lukewarm about fighting wind up fighting because of the very strong norms of collective action that install themselves in these armed groups. In others, though, soldiers doubt each other's commitments. They don't send each other fairly strong signals, for example. And you might not know a fellow soldier, or you might even know a soldier and know him to secretly, in fact, support the other side. An armed group might force soldiers to fight, or have volunteer recruitment demand very little of recruits, such that joining up doesn't really send much of a signal about somebody's willingness to fight. It might not insist on a rigorous training regime. You might witness other soldiers slacking, not bothering to turn up, and so very weak norms of collective action install themselves. The army might be riven by rivalries, by sub-factions, and here desertion is a lot more likely because you simply don't trust that another soldier is actually there to fight for a faction, is actually there to fight for the whole armed group, but instead potentially to fight for a sub-faction. So the first major issue is how these norms of cooperation and this sort of strong trust among soldiers emerges or doesn't emerge. The second big issue for me is whether coercion can make up for a lack of trust. A lot of armed groups employ punishments for desertion. This is pretty standard. It's pretty widespread. In fact, it's in lots of armies, and not just in civil wars. As a personal example, my grandfather, who fought in the U.S. Army in the Second World War, told, you know, my family in years later, they were actually made very, they were made to be very clear on what the punishment for desertion was in the U.S. Army at the time, which was execution. Now, during the Second World War, the U.S. Army executed exactly one individual for desertion, right? But if my grandfather's experience is anything to go by, the message was at least very clear. It's pretty standard to have punishments for desertion. You can ask yourself, does it work? Does it make up for a lack of trust within an armed group? I find that it certainly can, but I emphasize the limits. I think there is both a deterrence effect and a potentially a provocation effect. And in armed groups in particular, where there are quite strong factional rivalries or quite strong stereotypes about who's loyal and who's disloyal, a major problem emerges with coercion, which is that it winds up becoming arbitrary. So the punishments that soldiers experience are not necessarily linked to their actual attempts to desert, but to what the army presumes to be their disloyalty. A lot of them are preemptive. A lot of punishments are enacted preemptively against soldiers that the armed group presumes to be disloyal. And that generates a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy in which soldiers are provoked to leave before they have a chance to undergo punishment. So what I'm trying to do here is to build an account of desertion and fighting in civil wars that brings the fact that individuals have complex motivations and are often apolitical motivations, together with the real political character of conflict, you know, together with the image that civil wars have of being political struggles at a really fundamental level, but the reality as well that individuals who fight in those civil wars, the politics of the civil war isn't necessarily front of mind all the time when survival considerations are really important. So I try to bridge the gap between the political and apolitical character of civil conflicts, or what Stathis Kalivas in a really important article once called the Schmittian or Hobbesian character of civil conflict. To my mind, the grand political themes of civil conflict very often cash out in the interpersonal relationships among soldiers. And so, you know, part of what I'm trying to do in this relational approach to desertion then is to look at how soldiers navigate civil wars where they're seeking to survive and potentially to advance a cause, but in a world that's structured by their relationships with other soldiers, and all in the context of political ideologies and identities.
Now, the way that you sort of try to tease out this argument and provide evidence for it is primarily looking at the Spanish Civil War, right? Although you're very careful to bring in other examples to show how the argument might travel more broadly. And you also have a chapter in the book that looks at the Syrian Civil War, which I hope we'll have time to get to as well. Now, I'll admit the Spanish Civil War is not a case that I was very familiar with before I picked up your book. I suspect some of our listeners might need at least a refresher. So would you mind giving us just a little bit of background information on that war?
Absolutely. So the war lasted from 1936 to 1939, and it came out of the highly charged pre-war environment of the Second Spanish Republic, which had been in place since 1931. The politics of the Second Spanish Republic involved intense political mobilization prior to the war. And this permits me some leverage over this question about how political identities and ideologies shape people's lives. The Second Spanish Republic had a series of different governments. It started with governments on the left that had, the center-left that had a major reform project in place to reform multiple different aspects of life in Spanish society, from the status of women to the role of the church, to the role of the army in society. This major reform project butted up against very strong conservative, in fact, reactionary forces within Spanish politics and society. There was a subsequent right-wing government for a couple of years until the return of the left in February of 1936, several months before the start of the Spanish Civil War. The war itself then began with a failed coup attempt against the Spanish Republic, led by a cabal of officers, including the eventual leader of the rebels, Francisco Franco, who then was the dictator of Spain until his death in 1975. So this means that because the war starts with this failed coup attempt between the 17th and 19th of July, 1936, the problem of military loyalty is right there from the very, very beginning. And so it's an inherent part of the conflict. And essentially what happens is there's an attempt to take over the government immediately. As I say, it fails, but that divides the Spanish armed forces. The rebels and the Francoists wind up having sort of a majority of the regular Spanish military forces at their disposal and raise a number of militias as well to supplement them. On the Republican side, the Republic does retain the services of a very large chunk of the regular army and officer corps, but clearly in the minority compared to the Francoist side. And just like the Francoist side, they attempt to supplement this with a number of civilian militias, largely based on unions and political parties, and to a large degree spontaneously. There's a spontaneous mobilization of these militias at the very outset of the Spanish Civil War. And I say that the Republic tried to supplement itself with militias, but that's actually that's a lot more complicated. The Republic isn't fully comfortable with having so many autonomous militias emerge, and has a certain fear, you know, that that the militias organized by several of the more radical unions, especially, are going to wind up getting out of hand, and so resists arming the militias at first until it realizes that that it really doesn't have much of a choice. One of the dramas that occurs then on the Republican side over time is what to do about the militias and how to try to bring them into a militarized sort of into a centralized militarized structure. And so the war continues for several years, and it's a very slow conflict fought. After an initial rush towards Madrid by the rebels, the conflict gets bogged down, and in fact, there seems to be a deliberate strategy on the part of the Francoists to slow their advance in order to take over more of the country progressively and to cleanse it, as they see, of the left as they go. And so there's a series of a slow series of defeats essentially by the Republican forces until by April of 1939 the rebels managed to take control of the remaining provinces within Republican Spain, and eventually the fall of Madrid. The international politics of the Spanish Civil War is something I don't get into very much in the book, but is extremely important. So the rebels enjoy the support of fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. The Republic has the more limited support of the Soviet Union. And there's an attempt there's debates about what countries such as France and Britain ought to do, a willingness to not intervene, which winds up favoring the Francoists quite clearly when fascist Italy and Nazi Germany are willing to get involved. And there's also considerable participation of international forces on the Republican side, especially as many people know about the phenomenon of foreign fighters is something that that plays a very large role in the Spanish Civil War. Again, it's not something I get too much in the book. I focus mostly on the Spanish soldiers themselves. So what this history sort of allows me to do in the Spanish Civil War is to look at the variation in attempts to organize militarily. With the many different militias that emerge, especially on the Republican side, there's a sort of wild laboratory of wild experimentation in how to operate a militia, how to operate a fighting force, ranging from groups that look very much like armed forces with fairly rigorous discipline, with the expectation that soldiers obey orders on the one hand, to on the other end of the spectrum, highly undisciplined units, where it's made fairly clear to militiamen that they can kind of come and go as they please, where officers serve at their pleasure and not the other way around, where there isn't necessarily a clear expectation of being willing to fight over the long term. And there's a hope on the part of many that just the revolutionary zeal of these soldiers to resist the reactionary forces that the rebels are pushing will be enough, you know, to sustain a military effort. So there's a variation across militias at the start of the Spanish Civil War, particularly on the Republican side. There's an evolution over time where the Republic attempts to then control, to bring these militias under control and to impose new rules. And so there's variation over time with how the Spanish Republic organizes its armed forces. And there's variation between the Republic and the nationalist forces. So this variation is what winds up giving me, I think, a lot of leverage over what occurs, over understanding the signals that soldiers send, the politics that they live under, and then the desertion decisions they wind up making.
And the book really makes great use of that variation. So you begin your examination of the Spanish Civil War focused at the micro level, decisions that are made by individual soldiers. You focus on a province in northern Spain, and you look at how the composition of military units affected desertion rates. Now, all of these chapters are very, very rich chapters, but can you sort of summarize your findings there?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, I looked at one province, at Santander, where the military records were in particularly good shape, and so it was possible to reconstruct what units looked like. And so what I focused on was the composition of different companies in the Santander Army Corps. What I wanted to examine was essentially whether a soldier would be more or less likely to fight based on how many other soldiers in his unit, and I use his because we're talking about individuals that all in the records, but according to the rules of the army at the time, were men. So if any self-identified as female, we don't know about that. But so that's why I'll carry on using that pronoun. But what I wanted to examine was whether a soldier would be more likely to fight given the composition of his military unit, and given in particular whether he was fighting among other conscripts or volunteers. It's really easy to say, for example, that a conscript would be less likely to fight than a volunteer. It's fairly easy to make that claim. But what I actually find in the chapter is what's much more important to that than that is what the other soldiers in one's unit are. At least equally important, as important, is the percentage of a unit that's made up of conscripts or of volunteers. So I find that a conscript serving entirely among volunteers would be less likely to desert than a volunteer serving among conscripts. The idea here is that a soldier is carried on by the norms that develop within his armed group. So I think that's the central finding of the chapter. But I look at a couple of other dynamics within units as well. One of the themes of the book is whether just the strictly social ties among soldiers matter and how. So this is a longstanding theme in military sociology, the idea that friendships or bonds among soldiers are really important to keeping them fighting. And they can be, but the problem with that analysis is that bonds among soldiers can be really helpful to them to do things like desert together or to resist the army together. In the Vietnam War, groups of soldiers would get together to, for example, assassinate their officers. This isn't the sort of thing that is fantastic for military cohesion necessarily. And so what I look at in the chapter in order to tease that idea out is the social homogeneity of companies. It's often felt that birds of a feather flock together, and so that friendships or bonds among soldiers are more easily built among groups of soldiers that are relatively similar to each other in terms of where they're from, in terms of, say, their occupational background. And so I look at the social composition of these units and their age as well. So according to these three dimensions, their county of origin, their occupation, and their age, and I examine whether units that are more socially homogenous, soldiers in those units are less likely to desert. And what I find is that it actually really depends on the conscription rate. So what I mean by that is a socially homogenous unit is certainly less likely to experience desertion to the extent that it's volunteers. Once we're talking about conscript units, the fact that, for example, a group of soldiers might all come from the same place isn't necessarily going to be a thing that's going to reinforce the willingness of those soldiers to fight. The fact that soldiers all come from the same place and have all been conscripted together may lead them to build on their social bonds, perhaps by simply knowing each other before the war or getting to be finding friendships easier over the course of the war with soldiers that they didn't know beforehand. That social bond can be useful for them to desert together and not just to fight together. And so some of the reports of desertion that I read make this pretty clear. The army's worried about what happens when they put soldiers together who knew each other. The army's worried about what happens if they put brothers together in the same unit, particularly if one of them seems to be a little bit wobbly in terms of his loyalty towards their side. And finally, I look at factionalism, and I look at the idea that that mistrust can emerge in an armed group when it's riven by factional rivalries. And the key factional rivalry that I look at is a rivalry between two major Union confederations, and this was a feature of politics across, in many different places in the Spanish Republic. On the one hand, the Socialist Union Confederation, the UGT, and the Anarcho-Syndicalist Union Confederation, the CNT, these two major union federations that competed with each other for workers under the Spanish Republic, that supported different political factions that were much more or less willing to support the Republic itself. And what I found is that in companies that were polarized between these two big union confederations, that's to say evenly split between them, the desertion rate tended to be higher. And we see, again, in qualitative archive material and in some secondary analysis that I did of other sources written about the civil war in this province, that there was considerable concern among different factions for the place of their faction within an armed group, for trying to ensure that their own leaders would get senior positions within the armed forces and would be willing to promote their own within armed. So the result for mistrust seems to be fairly clear and fairly important. So so that's what I found in this province, that ultimately it's not just the individual motivations, the individual correlates of desertion that count, but really correlates at a social level within the armed group, and the characteristics of a unit that an individual finds himself in.
Now, we should mention that, in demonstrating these findings, you're relying on statistical evidence, but also qualitative evidence that's drawn from primary and secondary sources, as you mentioned. Now, there's this intriguing argument, which you mentioned, and that you call the provocation effect, right? This idea that punishing ostensible deserters can actually provoke desertion. There are these potential situations where coercion could become counterproductive, or desertion can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, as you said. So can you tell us about the evidence that you find on that? I think you look at the officer corps, is that right?
That's right. I look at the officer corps in the next chapter to a large degree because of the fascinating phenomenon of the preemptive punishments of officers at the outset of the war. So as I said, the Spanish Civil War began with a failed coup attempt, and this leaves the incumbent Republican side with a real problem. It's got a number of officers that are still within its army, but they're under immense suspicion. Do they really, in fact, secretly support Franco and the rebels. As I've said, the rebel side has a clear majority of the Spanish armed forces under its control. It's built on militarism. It's led by officers. There's a number of different reasons to suppose that officers really secretly support, you know, the other side. There's also a history of immense mistrust between the left and the uniformed security services within Spain. So, for example, in October of 1934, so that's to say a little less than 2 years before the start of the Spanish Civil War, there had been a miners' revolt in the province of Asturias, contemporaneous with another rebellion in Catalonia. And the Spanish army was called in to repress the rebellion, you know, and so these, including the colonial forces that had been deployed in Morocco, are called back to Spain to put down this workers' revolt. The paramilitary police, called the civil guards, are also widely reviled by the workers' movement on the left as basically being the repressive apparatus of the aristocracy, particularly in the countryside. So there's this immense mistrust between the left and uniform security services, but they've got a war to fight. So there's a real dilemma here. And over 1,000 officers appear to have been executed in the first few months of the Spanish Civil War. And so there's a great deal of ambiguity over these executions. A number of them appear to have been very clearly the punishment for actual attempts to defect and to join with Franco's forces, or actual attempts to support the coup attempt in the first place. It's pretty clear that many of these executions were quote unquote justified in the sense that they responded to an actual behavior. And so you'd expect those to deter others, right? It's a punishment for an action. And if the Spanish Republic is able to catch those officers who really attempted to defect and to punish them for it, you might expect a coercive or a deterrent effect on the rest. On the other hand, we don't know, and folks at the time very clearly didn't know to what degree these executions were in fact linked to actual attempts to desert. A number of them seem to have been arbitrary. You have the formation of popular committees in places across Spain in the early days as the shock of this coup attempt unfolds that target people who are seen as enemies of the left for violence, including members of the officer corps. So a number of the executions may have been completely arbitrary. And many of the officers that remained felt this to be the case. Certainly, there were a number of cases of officers who had friends who were shot, who, according to them, there was no way that they supported Franco, but they were targeted anyway. And there's no reason to suppose that executions that appear to be arbitrary should have that much of a deterrent effect. Quite the opposite. You know, we'd expect them to provoke greater degrees of desertion and defection. So I wanted to tease this out. And I had access to this absolutely incredible database of the military careers of the Spanish officer corps that was put together by Carlos Engel, who was a chemist and an amateur historian who was fascinated by the Spanish officer corps and who made it his work to develop this incredible database of their military career. And it's based on every time an officer's name comes up in an official record. You know, so we have their promotions, if they're reassigned, and a number of different records about their executions linked to pensions that their families wind up getting from the Francoist side after the war. This is somewhat problematic as a data source, and I just really want to acknowledge that. But it's pretty much the best that we have about these who may actually have been executed. And so what I do is I examine whether in a given sort of network or group of officers defined by officers serving in the same branch, right? So cavalry or infantry, for example, and in the same province, whether a high rate of execution among those officers correlates with a high rate of subsequent defection. And what I do is I differentiate between those groups that had a high rate of coup participation at the outset of the war and those that didn't. The finding then is that when there's a high rate of execution in a unit where very few officers had actually successfully managed to make it to the other side at the outset of the war, these are circumstances in which the rate of execution seems to be wildly disproportionate to the actual presence of disloyal behavior in a group of officers. And so you'd expect naturally for the provocation effect of coercion to be stronger there, for coercion to look a lot more arbitrary. And what I find is that it's exactly in those units with a high rate of execution without a high rate of initial coup participation where there are more defections that occur subsequently. So it really does appear that in these circumstances, efforts to sort of bring the officer corps to heel or to punish it collectively for the coup attempt backfired for the Republic. And they probably lost quite a lot of officers that might have been willing to serve. So that's how I attempt to tease out the effect of coercion in the Spanish Civil War.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it's very compelling evidence. Now, after that, the book kind of zooms out, right, or scales up to the macro level. So you move from decisions by individual soldiers up to the level of the unit or the army. You focus first on the Republican side, and you break up your analysis of the Republican side, looking first at the summer and the fall of 1936, and then looking at the period 1936 to 1939, where the Republic had regularized its armed forces. Can you sort of tell us about your analysis of desertion across these two chapters?
Sure. So I'll start with the summer and fall of 36. So as I said, you have all these militia forces that emerged at the outset of the war. And as I said, they have many different ways that they try to organize themselves, from imposing fairly rigid discipline to giving soldiers much greater degree of liberty to come and go as they pleased. And they advertise this. It's pretty clear that that different forces are pitching themselves as more or less disciplined as they're trying to recruit. And there's a massive degree of enthusiasm for the war on the part of a lot of people who are just outraged at the attempt by the right to roll back the social gains that had emerged in the Republic. But then how's the question is a bit, how's that channeled, right? And is it channeled into units where people are really prepared to fight a war, prepared to obey orders, or is it channeled into units where a number of opportunists can wind up settling in with, who don't really have to do very much to pay the costs of war and can still earn a decent wage, is the case, and gain the social status of being a militia member in a time of crisis, without necessarily having to commit to very much. And so what we find is a real difference in the militia that insisted on military discipline from the outset, that insisted upon the obeying of orders, that imposed a greater degree of training, and in particular, a set of militias organized by the Communist Party, although it included non-communists and members of different left-wing factions, a group of militias called the 5th Regiment on the one hand, and many of the other militia on the other. On the other hand, in the 5th Regiment, there are militiamen were made to commit very clearly to obeying instantaneously the orders of their officers. They made it very clear that the punishment, for example, for disobedience and desertion was potentially execution, you know, and that they and that was made very, very clear to them at the outset. Individuals who wanted to join a militia had a free choice. They could choose those militias, or they could choose to enroll in ones that advertised in newspapers their lack of discipline. That said, this isn't a barracks discipline. You if you want to come, you want to go, you're going to be able to. And so the willingness to join a disciplined unit, despite the opportunity to still be a militiaman, still gain a wage and have that flexibility, sent to my mind a fairly clear signal of willingness to fight, and was an important forge of strong norms of cooperation built on trust among soldiers. And what emerged in the militia that didn't insist on this level of discipline was a certain level of chaos, a certain level of norms that could wind up being very, very lax, where people would be surprised if somebody didn't go home at night, for example, but really wanted to stay with the unit and carry on holding a position, for example. At the same time, the militia are bedeviled by other problems. The fact that there are all of these different factions on the left means that there's a fair amount of chicanery among the militia and competition for the resources that are being provided to them eventually by the government. There are circumstances in which, you know, two militia from different political factions might be side by side in a village nominally fighting for the same cause, but one would advance and the other wouldn't support them. Or even, you know, probably the most, among the most sort of striking stories of this that I saw was one unit that had the artillery piece and the next unit down the line that had the shells, and they couldn't get it together to match the one to the other because, you know, that would be supporting the wrong faction. And so these are the sorts of things that really encourage a lot of mistrust on the part of a lot of the militia. And it's not to deny the real enthusiasm that so many militia members had. And to my mind, one of the important elements of the tragedy of the Spanish Civil War for the Republic is that this real enthusiasm didn't, in so many cases, wind up being channeled into a structure where militia could really have confidence in each other's willingness to fight. So that's really for the period of the summer and fall of 36. This structure is obviously problematic for a variety of reasons for the Spanish Republic, and militia units wind up falling apart as they attempt to fight the Francoists in a lot of places. And it's not just, you know, these less organized militias that experience desertion problems. Some of the 5th Regiment units did as well, but they seem to be able to provide a lot more resistance. So this circumstance is, you know, these attempts at military organization are pretty problematic for the Republican government. And the attempt, starting in the fall of 1936, is to bring them into kind of a centralized structure with a common set of rules about behavior and rules of discipline. And so a number of different processes take place. One is the government centralizes the militias into a common structure, forces them to accept a common chain of command and not to act all on their own, forces them to accept a set of common rules of discipline, and forces and creates as well and drastically expands the coercive apparatus of the state in order to try to, among other things, punish deserters, as well as, you know, in the eyes of a lot of political factions that have a rocky relationship with the government, to repress them. And so that means a lot of different things for trust and mistrust in the military forces operating for the Spanish Republic. And so it means a lot of different things for desertion. The other major change that occurs, and I ought to have brought this up perhaps even first, is conscription's enacted. All of the militia forces that I had mentioned at the outset of the war were volunteer militia, but as I said, with very different things that voluntarily joining up meant. Beginning in the fall of 36, a conscription becomes quite widespread until it's the dominant method of recruiting for the Republican forces. And so, again, as I say different things, this has different consequences for trust and mistrust. On the one hand, volunteer militia who chose to obey the order to militarize and to remain within the militia were committing to a greater degree of discipline. And so what I find happens is that volunteer forces become more reliable, and as the war wears on, and as volunteerism, soldiers who had joined up voluntarily, who remained voluntarily, even though, for example, there had not been a conscription order for them specifically, if they chose to remain voluntarily within the militia at that point, rather than to resign, they were committing to something more substantial than they had been previously willing to commit to. And so their capacity to resist the Francoist forces seems to increase. You know, but at the same time, there are a number of problems that emerge with militarization as well. The addition of wave after wave of conscription creates this problem, as I found in Santander province in the micro level chapter, where the influx of conscripts means that volunteers who had been around for quite a while now start doubting to a great degree the motivations of those who are around them. Well, you didn't join up in the first place. You just waited until your number was called. You know, how do I trust that you're really, you know, willing to fight? So that's a problem that emerges. The coercive apparatus of the state improves, and so deserters are punished much more regularly. And again, that seems to have a deterrent effect, but it also seems to come with a provocation effect. It's really regarded by some of the political factions in Spain at the time as a tool of repression by a government increasingly dominated by the Communist Party. So one of the things that happens, again, it's a war of multiple different political factions, is that a different Marxist-Leninist party, the PUM, the Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxista, so the Party of Marxist Unification, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification. So they're a Marxist-Leninist party that tries to distance itself from Moscow and is kind of critical of Stalin's regime, and is led by a former associate of Trotsky's. And so they wind up seeing the militarization order as a tool of repressing it, which to a large degree was. You know, it was used by communist authorities to target PUM members and to remove them as a sort of a problematic political faction. And so you wind up having PUMistas who are no longer willing to fight for a regime that seems to be willing to target them for political repression, regardless of the fact that they, you know, had been willing to fight against Franco. That's a set of complicated changes, but I think it offers a fair amount of leverage over the question with these overtime changes.
Now, you have a very interesting analysis of the rebel side as well, the nationalist army and the factors that shape desertion there. But I'm going to go to your final empirical chapter, which looks at the Syrian civil war. And, you know, this is really great because it shows us how your argument would apply in a different and more contemporary context. So what do you find regarding desertion across different armed groups in Syria?
Yeah, again, it's good to point out that we're looking at multiple different armed groups among Syria. Now, there are thousands, so I can't, you know, take them on. And indeed, when I talk about the Free Syrian Army, and I focus on five, one of which is the Free Syrian Army, we're really talking about... it's more of an umbrella, really, than a faction, so to speak. But I look at five different forces. So the Syrian government troops, Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS, the Kurdish rebels, and the Free Syrian of the YPG-YPJ and the Free Syrian Army, they range as well quite widely in the practices that they employ and in the level of trust and mistrust that emerges. So, for example, on one extreme, there's in Jabhat al-Nusra, for example, it's based on fairly strong pre-war jihadist networks. It's therefore soldiers who knew each other fairly well when it comes time to form a faction in the civil war, including ones who had known each other in Syrian prisons and who had been released deliberately by the regime in order to give the opposition a different cast, of course. It's based on voluntary recruitment and on commitment to a relatively rigorous training regime compared to a lot of other factions. And so it's a relatively cohesive force. The Kurdish rebels and the Kurdish militia and the YPG-YPJ, who have, you know, a different relationship, to say the least, to the war than a lot of the other factions, who wind up striking a deal and to some degree with the Syrian government, and who a lot of their fighting is against ISIS instead of the regime. Their practices are also relatively cohesive. There is the use of conscription, but the use of conscripts in only limited roles. And so the bulk of their fighting force is really voluntarist. And again, based on a fairly strong degree of discipline, although with significant regional variations. So you've got relatively cohesive forces on the one hand, ranging to Syrian government troops where there's this sort of paradox that's kind of interesting among much of the regular army, the regular conscript force. We're talking about soldiers who have very little motivation, very little trust in each other to fight. Conscription is the standard practice for recruitment. Widespread corruption means that soldiers have very, very little confidence in their officers. And the fact that the bulk of the conscript force is Sunni and is under immense suspicion from the regime as being willing to support the rebels winds up provoking a number of them to leave before they're in a position to be targeted. They're under such intense suspicion that a stray remark can really lead to very severe consequences for them. There are Sunni officers, even in Hisham Bou Nassif's research, for example, who were unwilling to park their cars outside of their mosque, lest they be detected as having been relatively religious Sunnis, and therefore coming under some suspicion. So this is a circumstance that winds up feeding the mass desertion from the Syrian armed forces in the first couple of years of the war. On the other hand, elite regime forces seem to hold together much better. And here, the fact that a lot of them draw very, very heavily on the Alawite community is an important factor. I think it's a little bit more complicated than just sectarianism. It doesn't just wind up being easily summarized by sectarian difference. The practices that the regime enacts to repress Sunnis and to make them targets of suspicion wind up driving their desertion behavior. So there's a variety of different military practices. I talk also a lot about ISIS in the chapter, and the fact that at the outset they look a lot like Jabhat al-Nusra in terms of insisting on obedience and discipline, but they also expand quite rapidly, and their norms of recruitment seem to drop substantially over time, whereas Jabhat al-Nusra deliberately remains small. ISIS also insists that members of different factions join them and swear their allegiance to ISIS, whereas Jabhat al-Nusra is willing to work with other factions but not insist that they join. And the consequence for that is a really interesting difference, where for ISIS, they basically wind up bringing in members of different factions who don't particularly want to join ISIS, but I feel a significant degree of pressure to do so. And so they expand quite rapidly, and they maintain their cohesion for a long period of time. But as ISIS starts to come under much greater pressure over time, this also creates significant structural weaknesses. The fact that they had expanded so rapidly and brought in so many soldiers whose commitment to ISIS was doubtful, to say the least, also enables them, in my analysis, to fall apart rather more rapidly. As for the Free Syrian Army, and here I think that there's, once again, a tragedy that's somewhat similar to the tragedy of the Spanish militias on the Republican side. There are many people who are, deeply committed to the cause of a free Syria and to the overthrow of the Assad regime, who had been willing to take on immense risks in the protest movement at the beginning of 2011. And it's one of the tragedies of the Free Syrian Army that it does not wind up bringing those individuals into a clear structure. where, with you know, clear, you know, for example, insisting all along the line on military discipline. Again, a wide variety of different norms emerge. Some units have very little training at all. It seems to be the main modus operandi in free and Syrian army units. Others insist on for example, you know, at least a certain training period. And so it translating the popular will to overthrow the regime to a willingness to fight a war is quite problematic. Many other individuals are normatively committed to nonviolence and strategically committed to the idea that it's really nonviolent resistance that's going to wind up damaging the regime and that a war is essentially impossible to win. And so the Free Assyrian Army does struggle to maintain cohesion. It also struggles from problems that my book's theoretical approach, I want to say, doesn't do a good job explaining. I think the desertion rate in the Free Assyrian Army winds up being higher than even I would have expected it to be, in part because of a simple lack of ammunition, cash, and ultimately food in some units. I think, you know, it sort of sets a scope condition to the degree to which trust and mistrust can really make a difference. If you don't have enough bullets, it's a little bit futile to fight. And questions of trust and mistrust don't really come up. I think the approach of my book, based on relationships among soldiers, does a pretty good job of explaining why some armies in the Syrian civil war managed to hold together much better than others, with some exceptions. But I think on the whole, it gives a fairly good portrait.
It's a very persuasive analysis, and it also helps us think about how your argument might apply in other contexts like Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and so on. But Theo, we've taken up a lot of your time. My final question is, you know, this book has been out in the world for a little while now. What is it that you're working on at this point in time?
Thanks for asking. I've got a couple of projects. One is on the consequences of foreign military training missions and the reasons why they seem to succeed or fail. And another is on civil wars that, like the Spanish Civil War, or to a large degree the Syrian Civil War, occur because of a military split and the circumstances in which divisions within an armed force can give rise to a civil war, with some somewhat grim speculations about the possibility of that occurring in the United States, unfortunately. So those are the research projects that I've got on the go at the moment.
Those sound fantastic. Well, Theo, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I hope you enjoyed. I'm glad that you enjoyed the book, and I hope your listeners do as well.
The book is Theodore McLaughlin's Desertion, Trust and Mistrust in Civil Wars, published by Cornell University Press in 2020. Thank you for listening.